you wake in a strange room. Your clothes are foreign, and the walls are covered in objects from a different world. You don't know where or when you are, or if you're still dreaming. There are footsteps in the hall. Jumping up, you race out of the room and into the streets. You have just entered the Twilight Histories.
You have entered the Twilight Histories, an audio adventure that casts you as the hero. Today, you will hear part two of Broham the Barbarian by Aaron Lund. In the last episode, you entered a Bronze Age world as a content influencer, creating hyper-realistic experiences for a gaming company. You tamed a massive bird and won the hearts of an ancient city to become their king. In part two, you will leave your city in search of an even greater adventure. I mean, content. Once you've finished listening to Broham the Barbarian part two, head on over to Patreon, where you will find a massive 1 hour bonus track to Broham. And now, Broham the Barbarian part two, by Aaron Lund.
This is how it should be. Just you, a set of tools and abilities, and an enemy base to take down. You have an objective: retrieve the Eye of Utu, and are even expecting a boss fight. It's a textbook third-person adventure quest, but in first person, in real life. It's all you've ever wanted. You worked hard not to get your hopes up about this adventure. You've been burned by claims of giants, monsters, and disembodied demons from the bowels of the underworld before. As you drag the uncooperative bulk of the sentry whose neck you just broke into a corner, beyond the reach of the light from the braziers, you gotta admit the quest giver hadn't been exaggerating this time. You scoot the corpse into the corner, formed by the crenellations atop the wall you're on. You turn around to face the interior of the complex and take a seat on the body, its latent warmth feeling rather welcome against the chilly night breezes. Still tucked away in the shadows, you figure you've got a few minutes to decide your approach. The broad, brick-paved walkway stretches off to your left and right. Thanks to your enhanced night vision, you can see a few other sentries pacing back and forth along the wall, looking bored. You aren't worried about yourself being seen. You chose a moonless night for this very reason. As long as you stay out of the light, you'll see them before they see you. Judging by the size of the dude you're sitting on, that's not a bad thing. She'd said they were large, and she hadn't been kidding. Shamhat, High Priestess of the Temple of Utu and Keeper of the Eye, had blown into Warka with a small, mildly bedraggled entourage of eunuchs seeking audience with the king. As luck would have it, you were in that day, having been king of Warka ever since you pushed the last guy into a fire pit meant for your terror bird, Spite. Not that you do much kingly admin of the city yourself. Although you enjoy a nice city builder, that kind of content doesn't really play to your demographic. At the recommendation of your corporate liaison, Mu, you appointed a viceroy to handle the day-to-day. You spend your time building your reputation playing the hero. Just you and Spite, your trusty steed, and Mu, of course, often tagging along, gathering her data. Apparently it was working, too, because it was to your throne room Shamhat scrambled when she found herself booted out of her own temple. "Heavy of brow and mean of aspect," she'd call the marauders. Whatever that meant. "Hulking and brutish," she claimed, "with squat, hairy bodies thick with ropey muscle. They were hunched and ape-like, yet the smallest among them stood a head above the tallest man at the temple complex." The marauders knew their business as well. It had taken no time at all to scatter the villagers who made their homes outside the temple grounds, secure the servants and temple prostitutes as hostages, and, of course, seize the treasures left in the temple's care, including the Eye of Utu. Shamhat herself only managed to get out with a handful of eunuch attendants and the clothes on her back. The secret tunnel they'd used, known only to the High Priestess herself, was crudely dug and suffered a collapse as they made their passage. That makes it useless for your purposes, but hey, you wouldn't want it to be too easy. Once Shamhat was settled into accommodations befitting her station, you got the rest of the story. She'd been hearing rumors of strange nomads people were calling the Enkidu. They were coming into the fertile corridor out of the western desert, raiding, pillaging, and making a general mess of things. However, bandits and marauders had never risked angering the gods by desecrating a temple before, so she made ready to receive the freshly injured and newly homeless, but beyond that paid little mind. It wasn't until they were at the gates and in her temple, and she was fleeing for her life, that Shamhat realized her mistake. Turns out these Enkidu out of the western desert weren't like other bandits and marauders the High Priestess had encountered before. They were a different kind of people, with a different kind of outlook that allowed for the pillaging of temples as rather plumb targets. Barbarians with gods that didn't seem to think the desecration of other gods' temples was any of their business. Shamhat wasn't having it, though. She wanted help getting her stuff back, is the long and short of it. As well as the people she'd left behind, of course, if something could be done for them. The High Priestess being rather fond of many of them, it seems. Worshippers at the temple swap news and gossip, and a lot of that, lately, had been about you. So she came to you, and now here you are. You must be doing your job. You inch closer to the edge of the walkway, which lacks even so much as a guardrail for comfort, and peer into a courtyard several meters below, one of a whole series of courtyards that ring the inside of the curtain wall. They're lousy with statuary and ornamental shrubbery, so plenty of cover. Which is good, now that you're rethinking your usual head-on approach. These fellas are real big. At the center of the complex, a ziggurat tapers upward like a smushed pyramid, the temple of Utu itself. Sandwiched between the ring of courtyard and the temple is a buffer zone of packed earth and brick-paved walkways. This area is brightly lit with large braziers at regular intervals. You'll be at a disadvantage there. The Enkidu are spread about, the ones you can see anyway. Some few wander the courtyards or chat in the light of the braziers. You can make out at least two mucking about the ziggurat's terraces, but most are in a single clump at the base of the temple's main stairway. The smell of their greasy cook fire, mingled with the sour musk of the body behind you, makes for a heady bouquet. All right then, what's the plan? Ideally, you'd like to be in the temple before these yahoos even know you're here. But there's just too many. You can sneak around doing stealth takedowns and it'd be dawn before you cleared a path. Plus, while you might think of them as NPCs, they aren't AI. They'll notice when their buddies turn up dead. Be real upset about it, too. No, your best bet is to draw them to one side of the complex and sneak in on the other, quietly knocking heads as needed. After you're in, you can find their leader, most likely the biggest guy with the fanciest swag. Once you've taken out the head honcho, the rest of the Enkidu will fall into line. Hopefully. Can't know for sure, but hey, it worked last time. You slink back to the corner and step over the body of the sentry to retrieve the rest of your kit. There's a copper helmet that, after a moment's consideration, you decide against. It's too shiny and throws off your hearing anyway. Besides, if one of these brutes manages to club you in the head or whatever, you don't think a few millimeters of hammered copper is going to be much help. All right, that clinches it then. You'll go minimalist. You leave the bow and arrows, along with your sickle-shaped sword. You want more stopping power for these Goliaths. You opt instead for a bag of round stones to go with your sling, the unwieldy lump of copper at the end of a stick you call a mace. You eyeball the spear, trying to make your mind up about it. Finally, you grab it, figuring, why not? Be a pain to lug around, but it'll make a good one-shot. You swing your mace over your shoulder and strap it onto your specially made leather harness. Trying to describe a shoulder holster but for knives to the artisans of Warka had been an adventure in itself, but the results are pleasing. The leather is well fitted and pliable, ostrich or something like it. Seems like everything is birds around here. A lot of stuff is made from them, including your kilt. Another of your own ideas, your tactical kilt, is knee-length and belted around your waist instead of cinched up to your armpits. You know, like clothes that make sense. Taken altogether, your heroing suit has become quite the hot look among the swaggering peacocks of Warka. You make it work for you, though. You hoist the sack of rocks, loosen the twin blades in your harness, grab your spear, and pad your way along the wall, keeping to the shadows. After a few minutes, you near another sentry, leaning at the waist over crenellations that come up to your shoulders. He's up to the job, alert, searching out for any disturbance in the flickering light of the small brazier behind him. But not in your direction, and so much the worse for him. You put on a burst of speed, which alerts the sentry, but not in time. You swing the bag of rocks at an upward angle into the side of his head. The connection is solid, and it's hard to hear the difference between the stones clacking and the bones cracking. Either way, the force of the blow sends him cartwheeling over the crenellations to the ground. One sizable sandal flies off an equally sizable foot and smacks into the brazier, sending it over the interior edge to smash upon the paved walkway beneath you. Bonus! The commotion draws the attention of some of the Enkidu down below. You see some thoroughly craned necks as they try to see past the light of the braziers. Good luck. You're about to get to work when you hear heavy footsteps coming at you from further along the wall. Another sentry, running blind but doing it quickly. Luckily, you have just the thing. You overhand your spear halfway down the remainder of the wall into the oncoming Enkidu's eye. Nice. You haven't even had to practice that much. Now, back to the task at hand. You dump the stones out of the sack, load one into your sling, and begin launching a steady barrage of missiles both into the braziers, further pressing your low-light advantage, and into the clump of Enkidu, scattering them every which way. You send stone after stone into cranium, kneecap, and groin, always a classic. When you're down to your last half dozen, you scoop them up and continue along the wall, letting fly as you go. By the time you're out of ammo, you've reached the body of that latest sentry, the point of your spear sticking a good half meter out of the back of his head. You grab the spear and wrestle it free, taking a good chunk of what's left of his noggin along with it. Man, brains is leaky. Anyway, all this ruckus ought to keep this lot busy for a minute. You flick the remaining blood and brains off the end of the spear, hop down from the wall, and silently make your way through the courtyards toward the rear of the temple. You round the temple having encountered only two more Enkidu. The first you garroted, using your sling, which was way more of a hassle than you'd thought it'd be, and broke your sling besides. The second you cudgeled with your mace, altogether a much better option. Fast and relatively quiet, as long as it can be done with one blow. Live and learn. Unlike the broad, grand stairway leading to an equally grand entrance at the front of the temple, the rear has only a ground-level doorway in a little alcove, for servants, perhaps. The door is thick and barred besides, but not particularly well-constructed. You're able to pry a plank loose with the point of your spear. Good thing you brought it after all, even if it did get a bit bent. Once inside, you pick your way through a maze of torchlit storerooms before coming at last to a heavily mosaicked landing with stairs going up one side and down the other. Decisions, decisions. From what Shamhat said, living quarters are in the upper part of the temple, a likely place for the hostages, while the temple's more material treasures are secured down below. But which way leads to the boss? Down, you decide, for not much more reason than a vague correlation with common trope. The stairs descend into an antechamber wide enough for three people side by side, or two Enkidu. At the opposite end is a set of heavy doors that won't give you any trouble because they're wide open. You guess the room beyond is the treasury, or was. The marauders have picked it entirely clean, save for torchlight, and a lone Enkidu standing with his arms folded and a smug look of expectation. Oh, of course, a setup. So, you're the boss man, you say.
I am one Kud of Enkidu, he says.
Okay, is that like a name or a title? You know what? Never mind. That whole thing with Shamhat, that was your idea, you say, more of a statement than a question.
The High Priestess belongs to me, yes.
I take it tales of Broam, hero of Warka, are on the lips of people far and wide, and you conjured up this elaborate scheme to get me here face to face to see if the truth measures up to the legend.
Just so.
Well, all right then, you say, stepping through the doorway to meet Onekud in the empty treasury. But you could have just asked, man. You're within a few meters of the final boss, psyching yourself for a pre-fight stare down when you hear the heavy double doors clang shut behind you. O-M-effing-G. Of course there are more Enkidu standing behind the doors. The whole setup couldn't be more obvious, and you just traipsed into it like a noob. Well, no time to cringe about it. Scrapping with one of these dudes in this limited space will be interesting enough. Two or more doesn't have a good outlook. You pivot while raising your spear, block two Enkidu even larger than the boss man, and hurl the spear at the furthest one before you even finish turning. The bent and blunted end of the spear caroms off the Enkidu's copper breastplate. It doesn't go through, but the force knocks him off his feet. Good enough for now. You let your momentum spin you completely around while you're swinging your mace in a windmill arc. The mace head spluts into the second marauder's face, caving it in and halting his oncoming charge to good effect. Ironically, if he hadn't been so tall, the mace would have whiffed right over his head. It just goes to show. Well, you're not sure what it shows, but it's something. You spare a glance at Onekud, verifying your guess that he's just watching this all play out. It's fun to be right. The first Enkidu is up on his feet again, looking displeased. You pull one of the copper blades from its sheath on your harness, catch it up by the tip, and send it flying hilt deep into his eye. You already had one eye shot tonight, and it's nice to have the set. You know, for symmetry. You turn to face Onekud once again. Give your mace a couple quick swings to flick off the viscera and say, "Does that do it for you?" Onekud lashes out, a whiplash undulation from waist to fingertip. You quick step to the side as something, either a short-handled spear or a long-handled sword, rockets past your head to lodge deep in the door behind you. Not the answer you anticipated, you were expecting something more glib. But what Onekud lacks in eloquence, he makes up in direct action. He plows bodily into you, nearly knocking you into the wall. You plant your feet and absorb the blow, but lose hold of your mace, which clatters to the floor halfway across the room. Onekud doesn't give you time to recover. He throws hands like Warkin bricks and you dodge and deflect. You wouldn't say he's flailing wildly, exactly. It's more directed than that. His attacks are explosive and unpredictable, but intentional. He's not just hoping brute strength and ferocity will carry the day. He's got you two-stepping, just out of reach, trying to buy a little time. Bit of a pickle, really. He's got too much reach on you. You could get close, inside his guard, where you'd have the upper hand in a fistfight, but no, can't risk it. You can't let him grab you. He's got size and weight on you, and despite your enhancements, sheer strength, too. If it came to grappling, he'd toss you around like a ragdoll. Still, can't hit back from way out here, out of reach. Not without your mace or whatever to make up the difference. Nope, you gotta lean into the only real edge you've got against him. You won't get tired. Just gotta keep from being murdered till he tuckers out. You lead him on a merry chase, juke to the left, right, and left again. You can take a swipe here and there, at his hands and arms as they're coming at you at least. Not sure what a punch to the forearm will accomplish, but Oh wait, you've got another knife. Yeah, just slide that out and stick, stick, stick. Oh, well, it's stuck all right. Up near the elbow, yanked right out of your hand. Does he even notice it? Why didn't you throw it? Stupid, stupid. Oh well, fun while it lasted. And anyway, he's starting to slow down. No one really lasts more than a few minutes pushing this hard. He's been going at it nearly 10. Kind of a shame, you're having fun. But this is looking like a wrap. As if in agreement with your inner monologue, Onekud abruptly halts his attack and hops back out of reach. After squinting at you in what looks like appraisal for a few beats, he lets out a sharp laugh, "Huh!" then doubles over, loudly trying to catch his breath. Unexpected. You've been tricked once or twice tonight already, and you don't intend to fall for whatever this is. As you sidle over to where your mace lies, Onekud lifts one hand to a stitch in his side, and through labored panting says,
"Take it up, if you like. There is no more fight in me tonight."
You reach the mace and bend down to pick it up, keeping the marauder in sight. You wipe the remaining blood and dirt off the mace head while watching Onekud get his breathing under control, trying to figure his angle.
"They said you were tireless," says the Enkidu,
sounding much better.
"The stories. Some speak of great strength, some of unbelievable speed. There are strange claims about birds that I don't quite grasp. But all of the tales say that you do not tire.
And you run toward that kind of thing, you say, giving your mace a practice swing. One could laugh.
We are a nomadic people, and every new place brings a new strong man. When people see the hero's head at the end of a spear, the fight goes out of them.
Ah, so that's what this is, you say, testing the backswing this time. What happens when they aren't helpful enough to die?
It has never happened before.
You chuckle. All right, then. What do you want to do? I don't really need to kill you guys. I'm sure we could work something out. He bristles a bit at your comment about killing them, but it passes quickly.
What do you suggest?
He asks.
Well, you'll have to clear out of here for sure. Otherwise, what's the point?
And leave all the bodies, too, you say, gesturing at his dead henchmen. People like to see that kind of thing. I'm sure you understand, what with your heads on sticks and all.
Of course.
Then I don't really care what you do. Just steer clear of Warka, I suppose. Oh, and I'll need the Eye of Utu. Can't go back empty-handed, you know. Not that you're really going to hand it back to Shamhat, who promised your top-tier subscribers new old stock antiquities. One could, having regained his composure, appraises you for a moment, tugging a tuft of hair on his chin to a point. It's odd. You'd think the amount of body hair on the Enkidu would translate to a thick beard on the face. Not so much. Finally, he says,
I have a different notion. Join us. You would make an excellent Enkidu.
Better than excellent, I'd say, is what comes out of your mouth. You've got to be the glib you want to see in the world, it seems. Sounds to me, though, like a great way for you to put me in a bad spot.
Of course it does. But how many have you killed here? Do you not trust in your strength?
Well, most of those dudes never saw you coming, but you see his point. You say, so what? We just rob and pillage?
Would you prefer to sit behind your city walls?
He's got you there. If you just wanted to chill in Warka, you'd be there now. Actually, it's kind of sounding like a fun idea. Although, why would your people accept me, you say? Just on your word?
Partly, yes, he says. Also, gathering like-minded people along the way is common. The main reason, however, is that you are small.
Huh. Well, that's... You don't know what to think about that. What you say is... I'll have you know that I am slightly above average height where I come from. One could chuckles. Not gonna lie, I'm intrigued. Interested, even. Couple things first, though. One, I'm not looking to lead. I've already found myself in charge of one bunch of unnamed characters, and I'm not looking to expand. One could look at you like the thought had never crossed his mind. And B, you continue, I'm not following either. I'm not taking orders. I will do, or not do, my own thing as I see fit.
Who among us could make you do otherwise? He says.
Well, he's a flatterer, but it's working. You're actually kind of excited. This could be a lot of fun. And it might be the best way to keep them out of Warka. You don't want them anywhere near your stash of relics. All right, then. Let's get to it. Just let me get my ride, you say. And seriously, though, I want that eye. Back home, before you'd ever heard of Twilight Histories, you hadn't really thought of nighttime as dark so much as light of a different flavor. With city lights bright enough to pass for high noon when bleeding around the edges of your blackout curtains, the idea of a starlit sky seemed as fantastical as the realms of fairy or tales of djinn and magic lamps. Here, there are no city lights to blanch the heavens. The stars are so many, it's hard to say if they seem more like a gajillion individual pinpricks in velvet blackness, or a milky haze sketching out the landscape in silhouette. It never gets old. Soon enough, though, another silhouette takes form. The round crest of a low hill traced by the ruddy glow of a bonfire behind it. That'll be the Enkidu camp, then. If you're going to change your mind and hightail it back to Warka, now would be the time to do it. In the end, the marauders at the temple hadn't left their dead behind, and you're strolling into a strange camp, along with half a dozen corpses of their friends and loved ones who you killed. Probably not the brainiest thing you've ever done, but it'll be fine. You lean forward in your saddle and scratch behind your terror bird's ear, you think? Oh, whatever. She seems to like it anyway. As long as you've got your bestest girl spite, you've got nothing to worry about.
How is this bird bound to your will? One good asks, walking alongside you on your mount, giving Spite the side eye. I notice you do not give it commands. Yet the beast seems to know what you desire of it. Is this the work of the sorceress I'm told of?
A sorceress, huh? You say. Yeah, I guess Moo could be called that. Well, the way she tells it, old Spite here doesn't really know what I want, or even do what I want, per se. It's more like she experiences what I want her to do as her own idea. As far as Spite knows, she's doing her own thing. Hell, she might even think I'm doing what she wants.
That is both impressive and unnerving, he says. I wonder, does it cause you to consider what or who might be doing your sorceress's will while thinking it was their own?
Well, I am now, you say. But, nah, I'm pretty sure it only works on birds, at least so far. And anyway, she only has so much of the, potion that makes it work.
She cannot make more?
Yeah, but not without going back to the faraway land we came from. This place doesn't have the right Eye of Newt or whatever.
I see, he says. But what of you? I have never before seen one of your kind with your prowess. Is this more of this Moo's work?
You laugh. Yep, you got me. Without Moo's magic, I'm just another puny human. And before you ask, no, she can't sorcerize. What's the word I'm looking for here?
Ensorcel.
Right, thanks. She can't ensorcel you with the same power-up she gave me. Not without going back to that faraway land I was talking about. And well, good luck with that.
One could grins.
It's subtle, but enough that you're sure you've guessed his interest. You decide to change the subject. So you're going to clue me in as to why walking me into this camp alongside a heap of dead bodies I created is a good idea and not a death trap?
One could walks a few beats and then answers. For one thing, you won't be the first warrior to join our ranks after killing some of our number. Many will not be happy, but neither will they be surprised.
I guess that makes some sense, you say. But you mentioned something about being small?
Yes, I was coming to that.
He gazes into the middle distance a few more beats, then picks up the thread again.
You may have noticed I am somewhat smaller than the rest of my men here.
Well, sure. But so what?
In most cases, I would agree, he says. So what? But for me in particular, and now for you, there is an important tradition involved.
It sounds like you're going to give me a lot of exposition, you say. Maybe just the highlights.
Very well. Hundreds of generations ago, the ancestors of my people lived far to the west. There were many kinds of people, always warring with one another. Legend has it that the smallest of them rose up, a rat among giants. Small though he was, this warrior king bound the different peoples into an empire, heralding a new era of peace and prosperity for all. So, while he is known by many names and titles, my people call him the Herald.
Some of this rings a bell for you, but you don't interrupt.
Over the centuries, the kingdom became corrupt and unjust. Once again a day came when a small one such as yourself rose up. This time not a warrior king, but a prophet of letters, who sought to bring the dark and fallen empire back into the light of justice.
Now it's really starting to sound familiar. Moo told you much of Twilight History's prior involvement in this world early on. Not that you remember a lot of it. How did that turn out, you ask?
As you might guess, he says, generations of bloodshed. The empire fractured, came together, and fractured again. Many peoples fled the endless violence, including our own ancestors. They were not the largest or smallest, the weakest or most powerful. Just a group among many others who had had enough. Our stories tell us they moved north through a great desert until the desert became fertile. There they settled and lived for generations until the desert began to reclaim itself, and they were forced to move again. We've been wanderers ever since, but... And this is what I'm coming to. The Herald and the Prophet have been with us always. You find yourself actually intrigued, say. All right, hit me with it. I'm invested now. One could smiles. Among the Enkidu, kingship is earned. One who can show themselves worthy of being followed through wisdom and prowess in battle will gain support and be hailed as king. However, in deference to the Herald and Prophet, when a new king is named, one of our number who was smaller and weaker than the rest is chosen to be a kind of joint ruler. This is the Short King. You stifle a laugh. the Short King? Is there something humorous about that? Actually, no, you say, reining it in. You know what? Nope. I'm here for it. Please, go on. Very well, he says. The Short King may have some say in affairs, but the role is usually a ceremonial one. If, though, one has the wits and the will, the role of the Short King can be parlayed into a position of real power, just as the Herald and Prophet once did. Ah, that's you, I take it. You're the real Short King? Indeed. What happened to a tall king, you ask? You put a blade in his eye in Shamhat's treasury. Now let us not dwell on that. My position is secure enough that I shall soon be tall king, as you say. You, my friend, shall be short king, in the purely ceremonial fashion, of course. Of course, you say. And then what? Then, Broom of the faraway land, hero of Warka, you shall taste the life of the barbarian. On a dusty hillside, high above the dewy valleys of the fertile corridor, a band of marauders, you among them, steer a flock of glossy black emu-sized birds out of their pen to be driven back to the Enkidu encampment. The smell of smoke is heavy on the air, and you turn to see a grouping of small huts blazing away, the clay bricks of their walls cracking and blackening as the roofs collapse inward, sending ash and embers swirling through the updrafts. With the task well in hand, you give your terror bird a mental nudge, spurring her towards the carnage, looking for one could. You spy him stalking away from the flames, burning branch in hand, leading from the front as ever. He comes to an outbuilding, much like the huts were, only larger, and tosses the torch almost casually onto the roof. The barn, you guess it's a barn, erupts with cries of rage and anguish. A dozen or more people, humans by the look of them, flood out of the building and swarm one could, attacking from all sides with farm implements and any other kind of improvised weapons they could manage. He has the strength, but they have the numbers. Perhaps he was leading a little too far out in front. The other marauders hear the commotion and abandon their emu wrestling to help, but you'll get there first. At the speed of thought, Spite is bolting across the pasture, with you standing in the stirrups bellowing a war cry. In no time, you're among them, body-checking them into the dirt. Spite lashes out with beak and claw, opening throats and bellies with great gouts of blood. Soon the herders are either dead or have fled, and Spite's rampage peters to a stop. You plaster the biggest, gooniest grin on your face manageable and wait for one good to uncover his head. Soon he does, and you're rewarded with a terse nod of appreciation. You gotta hand it to the warrior priests of Tiamat. Small and wiry they may be, but they are tenacious and bloody organized. Given their temple is carved into the living stone at the apex of a high, solitary rock spire, that probably shouldn't have been a surprise. Effort like that requires some level of organization, now that you think of it. Not that it helps at the moment. It had made sense. The switchbacks up the spire being narrow and treacherous, you being the smallest and most nimble, the conclusion was obvious. It should also have been obvious that the priests had planned for just such a thing.
probably would have been, too, had you bothered to consider it even a smidgen. Instead, you lashed together a few thick wooden slabs for cover and started scrambling up flight after flight of three-quarter-scale stairways as the vanguard, directly into a hail of stones and projectiles so heavy and sustained that your shield has easily doubled in weight with the number of toy-like spears and arrows sticking out of it. They hit surprisingly hard, too, probably hurling those spears with atlatls. Seems like overkill. Now you're in a tight spot. It's a matter of angles. If you stay right where you're at, on a landing just narrow enough to be uncomfortable, they can only get at you from above. If you try to push forward, though, or even retreat, you're going to start taking fire from at least one more direction than would be strictly healthy. You consider hopping down, but you're just high enough to nix that as a really viable option. You think maybe you could just charge up the rest of the way, full blast. Normally that's exactly the kind of thing you'd do, but the weird child-sized scale of everything makes it more than likely you'd miss a step and tumble off anyways. There were a few close calls when you were moving up the spire carefully as it is. Well, there's nothing for it. You ready yourself for a berserker charge, hoping for the best. You're about to kick off when, wham! Something solid and heavy, likely a chunk of stone dislodged from the cliff face, slams into your shield before bouncing off and dropping to the ground below. The wood splits and knocks you in the head. Your foot slips off the edge of the landing. You overcorrect, leaning sideways away from the edge, only to knock your head again, this time into the face of the rock spire itself. Head pounding, leg flailing, you struggle to recover your balance, but before you can, wham! There's time, there's no hope for it, you're going over. You fling the shield away from you, curse this world for its lack of guardrails, and slip out into the open air. This is gonna suck. You close your eyes and wait for the impact. Instead, you feel a vice-like grip clamp around your lower leg, bringing your fall to a jarring halt. You open your eyes to see one could, clinging to the side of the spire like a fun uncle on a kid's jungle gym. He must have clambered halfway to your position while the warrior priests were preoccupied. The smile on his face tells you you're never going to live this down. You return it with a flippant salute. It's likely closer to dawn than midnight, and the bonfire has burned down to mostly just embers. The night of boasting and boozing has run its course, and all but a few marauders have gone in search of other pursuits. You held your own on both accounts, in no small part thanks to your heightened metabolism. You can't drink enough, fast enough, to get anything more than a light buzz. Not for lack of trying, though. Ah well, probably for the best. A couple more Enkidu, not standing on ceremony, get up and disappear into the darkness without a word. Now it's just one good, polishing off what, in your hands, would look like a comically oversized turkey leg, and you, poking at the glowing coals with a fire-blackened stick. Soon there's a commotion, screaming and wailing, not for the first time tonight. The recently departed Enkidu have found their way to the corral, where the human women taken captive earlier today are being kept. You're so busy trying to decide how you ought to be feeling about it that you're a bit startled when Onecood says, "What of you? They are women of your own kind, after all. Do you not wish to enjoy them?" You shoot back, and oddly defensive, "You're sitting here, too." Onecood laughs. "True, but I don't much care for women of your kind. And besides, I prefer my partners to be more willing." "Yeah, well, same here, maybe," you say, tossing away your stick and crossing your arms as casually as you can manage. "You vex me so, Broham," says Onecood, throwing away the remnants of his late-night snack to sizzle in the embers. "Why do you join us in our pillaging if not to avail yourself of the spoils?" "I take my share of loot," you say, thinking of the stone figurine, hammered copper brooch, an intricately woven feather shawl you've collected in as many days.
"Baubles and trinkets," he says. "More is your due, if only you would take it."
You think for a minute and say, "Yeah, maybe, but it's like, there are kind of these rules I gotta follow."
"Rules,"
Onecood says, like he's never heard the word before. "Yeah. Remember that faraway land I come from? Well, I can't be the kind of person there that I am here. No pillaging or anything, except in games, you know, like, pretend. But so, I wanted to know what it was like for real, though. What it would be like to make unscripted choices for myself and carry them out with my own hands, you know?
With your own hands and magical strength given to you by a sorceress, he says.
Yeah, well, can't blame a guy for wanting an edge, right? Anyway, that's what I'm getting at. It's like, I can't get here from there without help, right? And Moo and her co-sorcerers want to test out their new magic. And so we make a deal. I'm their guinea pig, and they get me here.
Where they let you pillage for fun.
Right. Well, not like that. They don't let me. But yeah, you say. It's like, I've done things here I couldn't do in that faraway land. Things I wouldn't do. But there are still certain transgressive behaviors that Moo and the other sorcerers don't want to be associated with. They'll, like, violate the user agreement.
I see. That all seems very reasonable, One Good says. However, I ask you this. Would you partake in these transgressive behaviors if not for Moo and this user agreement?
That is an uncomfortable question. I want to say no, but let your response trail off and punctuate it with a shrug.
You've drawn a number of lines in the sand since you got here, and crossed just as many. Seems you can always move a little further down the beach.
What happens if you violate the agreement? Can they take their magic back?
Asks One Good.
I'm not entirely sure, you say. Not without returning to the faraway land, anyways. In fact, the plan has always been to reverse the procedure when you get back home, but he doesn't need to know that.
One Good nods thoroughly for a moment and says,
Broom, if you are happy with your arrangement, then I am not one to dispute it. I would point out, though, that you yourself have said that you came here to act of your own will, but have already submitted your will to others.
Well, I don't know about that, you mumble, not very sure of yourself.
How not so, he says, with a bit more oomph. Can you not see that they have given you a sword and told you to chop wood with it? They have given you power, but have kept the will for themselves.
You purse your lips, thinking. He continues.
Your bird, Spite, has great strength and speed, but must use it as you bid, yes? As long as she must act on your will, her power belongs to you. But let me ask you this. What would you do if Spite refused your commands?
I can't. I don't know.
But you would have to do something. You would have to respond to her in some way, and that gives her the will. Broom, my friend, take the sword that they have given you and use it to cut the bonds that tether you to their will. There are times we must spit in the faces of our gods, if only to show them that we can. Only then can you truly stand on your own feet, fight for fortune and glory, and take the spoils you deserve.
Yeah, you say, quietly. Maybe. You sit in silence for a long moment, listening to the cries of rage and despair wafting through the camp, and you think to yourself, maybe not.
The sunlight reflecting off the cracked and worn clay pavers of Warka's main drag isn't doing any favors for your mood. It's been about 3 lonely weeks since you and Spite began to mosey back to Warka from wherever the Enkidu had last made camp. Who knows how long you'd have been wandering the wilds if left to navigate on your own. Luckily, Spite has a homing function thanks to the Cordy stuff. You only had to impart the vague imperative of home to your terror bird, and bing, bang, boom, you were at the city gates in no time. Not that anyone else was. You were looking forward to the usual hero's welcome you're used to getting upon your triumphant returns. Usually they get a party going as soon as they spot your head popping up over the horizon. This time you had to cajole the gatekeepers into getting off their butts to let you in. Things have gotten lax around here since you went to hang with One Good. What, 6 months ago? Man,
Time flies. Maybe those gatekeepers are new. Buzzkills is what they are. You gotta admit, though, you've been in a sour mood since that campfire bro sesh with Wankud. Maybe you needed to hear it, but it kinda harshed the good time vibe you had going. You packed up and set out on Spite maybe half a month later. Had to come home to Warka and sort things out with Mu. Not that you're sure what you mean by that. You make your way through a crowd which seems more and more to actively want nothing to do with you. Did that old granny just give you the stink eye? Whatever. Mu will be able to tell you just what exactly is going on around here. You stop at the stable, purpose-built to house precisely one animal, only to find it full of clutter and cobwebs. With the stablekeeper nowhere in sight, you tend to spite yourself, unsaddling and feeding and grumbling all the while. Having built up a head of steam, you search out Mu in her apartments. You reach her door, give the heavy wood a couple hard knocks, and call out, "Mu, you in there? It's Broham. We need to talk." The door swings inward to reveal a younger woman. Well, younger than Mu. Older than you, probably. Mu's maid, or assistant, or whatever. What's her name? Can't remember. It doesn't matter. Anyway, she's just staring at you like, what? Not gaping open-mouthed in awe of your presence, and it's like the last straw it really is. You're about to brush her aside and storm into the room when you hear, "Let him in, Shala. He is the prodigal son, after all." Shala, that's her name. She steps aside and goes back to doing, whatever, you don't care. You stride manfully into the apartment, gearing up to just really get into it, when you notice how very empty it is. Instead of the usual ordered chaos of Mu's mixed-use work-living space, there's only an assortment of neatly packed reed baskets and wooden crates. All of your best rehearsed lines go out the window as you watch Mu and Shala stuff the last few odds and ends into some leather satchels. "What's going on?" you say, kind of out loud, kind of to the room at large. When it seems neither woman has taken any notice, it all seems to hit at once. The stuff Wankud was saying, the complete non-reception of the Warkan people, nobody explaining anything to you. It all builds up until you explode with, "What the hell is going on?" Both women stop what they're doing and appraise you for a long moment. Finally, Mu holds out her satchel and says, "Shala, dear, would you be so kind?" Shala takes the proffered satchel, gives you a look which can only be described as intentional indifference, and returns to her work. "What's on your mind, Broham?" says Mu. "Well, first, what is this? Why are you packing?" you ask. "Because we're leaving, obviously," she says. "What? Why?" you say. "And who's leaving? You and Shala?" "You and I are leaving Warka," she says. "Shala has roots here, so it's rather a big ask for her to tag along. Though she's welcome, of course." You can't believe it. Leave Warka? You're king here. She can't just make these decisions without asking you. This is exactly what Wankud was talking about. "I'm king here," you say, sounding more petulant than anything. You lower your voice, trying to sound more commanding. "You can't make these decisions without asking me." Mu knits the fingers of both hands together, tapping them against her pursed lips with a look of practiced patience. "First of all, you were king here, half a year ago," she says. "You skipped town to terrorize the countryside with your marauding buddies. You're not their hero anymore. You're a barbarian. Not in the pulp comic sense of the word, either. To them, it's a bad thing. You've lost their trust, and they've moved on. Warka is Shamhat's city now." "Shamhat?" you say, puzzled. "But she works for Wankud, the Enkidu king. He sent her here to bait me into a trap." "Yeah, and it wasn't hard to figure out, either. I could have told you that myself if you'd waited 10 minutes for me to talk to her before you ran off to the rescue. It doesn't matter now. She's in, you're out. Which brings me to my second point, which is that you are not, in fact, a king. You're a moderately successful content creator from Grand Rapids. Now, can we get on with it? There are any number of cities, much like this one, for us to start fresh in. Your belongings are already packed. Let's go." Somehow the basic facts of your actual life strike you as an insult. You were a king. You are a king. No! This is just like Onecood said. You keep making rules for my power. I can take Warka back from Shamhat. I'll do her like I did Bill Games. But you keep taking all the will. Roam, I sincerely have no idea what in the world you're talking about, says Mu, rubbing circles into her temples. Man, how come real arguments never go how they do in your head? You're not explaining yourself any good at all. Why can't you say it like how Onecood did? It all had made so much sense. But wait a minute, what did she say? Your stuff is already packed? Wait, how are you already packed up, you say? I just got back a few hours ago. Birds, she says. Avian drones. I've had eyes on you the whole time. You've been spying on me? I've been looking after my investment, she says. Roam, you've used the technology yourself. How could you be surprised that you're trying to control me? You blurt out, suddenly furious. It's clear now that Onecood was right about everything. The power and will and all that. The last thing you can do now is run after Mu with your tail tucked between your legs. Gotta make a stand. You turn and bolt back through the door, slamming it shut behind you. You yell, "No! We're not going anywhere! I'm taking my throne back. I can make the people of this city bow down to me again, believe me, and you're staying right here." There's a rectangular stone pedestal to the side of the door, holding some kind of statuary. You tip it over in front of the door to keep it from opening. After the dust settles, you hear the creaking of hinges, and the door opens into the room, revealing the baffled expressions of the women inside. Feeling like an idiot, you turn to another pedestal, knock the statue off it with a surly grunt, and start dragging it over to stack on top of the first one. "Broom, stop. This is physical coercion," says Mu. "You're about to violate the user agreement." "I'm not even gonna touch you," you squeak out between heaves. "You don't have to," she sighs. "Did you even read the agreement?"
"Much of it," you say. "No."
"Oh, good lord. Look, I'm informing you now. If you block my exit from this room, it will constitute physical coercion as stipulated in the user agreement. I'll be forced to find you in violation of said agreement."
"Do what you gotta do," you say, slamming the heavy stone pedestal down atop the other.
"Just do it from in there." "Very well," says Mu. And then, nothing. You wait a little while, unsure what for exactly, and say, "Okay then, I'm gonna go, be king again."
"Try if you like,"
comes Mu's voice, muffled by the stone.
"You might be able to stage a coup in the next, 6 to 10 hours.
You don't like the sound of that. "What do you mean?" you ask, maybe starting to regret the fit you've been throwing.
"Per the terms of the user agreement, having been found to be in violation of same, your license to make use of proprietary Politco biotechnology has been revoked. System shutdown has been initiated. Your enhanced abilities will diminish over the next 24 to 36 hours, then you'll be back to normal. Like I said, though, functionally, you have 6 to 10. By then, you'll be more or less incapacitated by symptoms of organ rejection. I'm told it's like the worst flu you've ever had."
All of your self-righteous rage spills right out and you buckle immediately.
"Wait! No! Look, I'm sorry. I got carried away."
With manic energy, you push the topmost pedestal away from the door to go skidding across the floor.
"There, easy peasy,"
you say, voice more shrill than ever.
"I was a jerk. Please, don't turn them off."
On some level, you're incredibly disturbed by how afraid you are of losing your abilities. You've gotten so used to them that that's how you think of them, as yours. But these notions feel fuzzy and unimportant compared to the all-out panic surging through you at the thought of going back to normal. "The process is irreversible, I'm afraid," she says, a little too matter-of-factly for your liking. "The designer cordyceps, along with the biosynthetic glandular system and everything else, were rendered invisible to your immune system by a series of enzymes. Shutdown of production of those enzymes was designed as a failsafe. It's a one-way thing." The defiance that had so recently guttered out begins to rekindle within you as this information sinks in. "Why wouldn't you tell me that?" you say, trying to keep your voice steady. "I wouldn't have... None of this would have happened if you had just told me that." "All of this was spelled out in the user agreement, which you chose not to read. Look, there's still a good 3 months of in-world time before our scheduled extraction. Plenty of good data can be gleaned in that time. I'm heading to another city. You're welcome to join. In fact, I recommend it. You've used up any and all goodwill you once had here. When the people discover they no longer have cause to fear you, well, like I said, you'd do better to come with." You find the very idea absolutely revolting. "You think that after all this, I'm going to follow you around like some scolded puppy?" you say, with a tone just dripping with incredulity. "Whether I read the stupid agreement or not, you still could have told me. But no, you just gotta be petty. And now you expect me to just tag along and what, hold your stupid beakers or whatever? No, I'm going back where they want me there as a friend, a brother, not just some trained lab monkey." Moo stands there listening to all this, eyes scrunched tight, pinching the bridge of her nose with her fingers. Finally, she inhales deeply, opens her eyes, and through lips pursed in exasperation, she says, "Okay then, bye-bye." You feel like crap. "The worst flu you've ever had," is what Moo said about it, and she hadn't been kidding. Where you're from, you'd be hard-pressed to find a vehicle that wasn't self-driving. You take it completely for granted. Tonight, though, you've never been more grateful to be able to make some kind of forward progress under someone else's steam. Just being able to puke on the go without having to crumple into a heap on the ground every 20 minutes or so is a real time saver. Spite doesn't have much cause to be thrilled about it, but she doesn't complain. Not even when the watery bowels kicked in. She's a real champ. Seriously, though, it's becoming a challenge to keep a positive outlook here. You're beginning to think you might have messed up. Judging by the 6 to 10 hour estimate you were given for the onset of symptoms, you must have hightailed it out of Warka like 20 hours ago. Feels like it anyway. You wish you would have at least asked how long they'd last. You wish you would have done a few things differently, actually. But there's nothing you can do about any of it now. You pull your head up from the crook of your terror bird's neck where you were resting, and lean over to heave. Nothing comes up, of course. You got nothing left. You've never been so thirsty, but you didn't bring any water or food or anything, really. You were so angry and focused on getting the hell out of Dodge, you didn't even saddle your mount. You just hopped on Spite and rode right out of town, with just the clothes on your back and a pocket full of simmering resentments. On top of all that, it didn't take long for it to dawn on you that you didn't have any idea where you were going, actually. The best you could do was impel Spite to go back to the Enkidu camp in some ill-defined sense and hope for the best. And that was, who knows how long ago that was. You just know it's dark, you're sick and tired and shivering cold and straight up not having a good time. You wipe your mouth on your forearm, nestle back into the crook of Spite's neck, where you feel slightly less like you want to die, and pray for relief to whichever god might feel inclined to answer. You awaken on the ground, curled up, teeth chattering. A wave of warmth hits you. No, not hit. It's softer. The warmth laps against you like ripples on a pond. It brushes against your face and arms like butterfly wings. breathing new life into clammy skin and tortured muscles. The relief is almost unendurable. You sit up and open your eyes to see a flickering orange glow blurry through tears of gratitude. You rub your eyes with the heels of your palms, clearing your vision enough to reveal a small fire and nothing else. It isn't burning anything like wood or whatever, nor is there any smoke like you'd expect. Just a waist-high splash of fire, a droplet of fire, burning merrily a hand span above the ground, bathing you in delicious, life-giving heat. You've never been so happy to see anything in your entire stinking life. You hear a strange whining or keening, faint at first, but growing louder. It almost sounds like the whinny of a horse, though it must be a bird. Everything's birds around here. A darkness begins to take shape within the fire. Not a cast shadow, but rather a dark emanation, an anti-light, growing and pulsating like the flapping of wings. Rays of darkness are cast out of the strange fire in all directions, deluminating everything they touch. Where the rays pass across your body, you feel obscured, diminished. Your pain and your relief from pain are less there, less demanding, and that, in itself, is a comfort. More and more, the dark rays focus upon you, offering a sweet oblivion. And, somehow, an unspoken question. You're being asked something you could never put into words. There are no words, just a kind of knowing. Just as you know the only possible answers are assent, or the other one. Heavy jostling pulls you away from what must have been a dream. Even now, it recedes from memory, leaving only impressions of warmth and beauty and something like the whinny of a horse echoing in your ears. You open bleary eyes and blink at the hazy shapes, waiting for your vision to adjust, only to realize this might be as good as it gets. Not a mood lightener. A voice in the dark says, "Ah, Broom, you are still with us. You had us worried." It's One Could's voice. Thank the gods. You've no idea what you would have done, what you even could have done, if it had been literally anyone else. "I hope I can see from one brother to another. You look like death." You try to laugh, but it comes out more of a tooth-chattering rasp. One Could gestures to some of the others, and you soon find yourself wrapped in a coarse blanket and propped up against a tree while waiting for their cook fire to get going already. For a while, they go about their business, roasting meat on spits and rehashing the goings-on of the day. You pay little attention. You just soak up the heat until the shivers run their course. There's no way to know how long you slept, but it seems to have brought you through the worst of the nausea. Small favors. You sit up a bit and try to take in the scene through deadened senses. Man, it feels like you're half blind and deaf. It's going to be a long adjustment. "When did you guys find me?" you ask. "How long was I out? Do you know?"
"We found your bird, actually. A scouting party spotted her pacing around in circles. When they got closer, they saw you curled up here under this tree."
"Oh man, Spite! Do you know where she went?"
"What if the Cordy stuff wore off? What if she's gone?" You can't bear to think about it.
"She is around here somewhere," he says. "She seems apprehensive."
"Yeah, her and me both," you say, searching the edge of the firelight with infuriatingly ineffective eyeballs. You turn to search behind you and get a look at the tree you've been leaning against. It's lumpy and gnarled, and looks almost singed.
"Huh. You know, I think I recognize this tree."
You reach out and draw your fingers down the trunk. They come back smeared with something like greasy black soot.
"Yeah, this is it," you say, strangely nostalgic. "This is where Spite made her last stand after I ran her down.
All of our adventures began here."
crazy, you think. Is this where Spite came when she got the command, go back? To the place where she was first imprinted? It's as good a theory as any. Yeah, and Moo herself had wanged good old Buzzy right into the Terror Bird's head. Where was that rule-breaking energy when you last saw her in Warka?
Very fitting, says Onecood. Beginnings and ends.
Yeah, you don't know the half of it.
How so?
She did it, man. She unsorceled me. I did like you said. I spit in her face. Not literally or anything, but I, like, defied her, and she undid it. She took my power.
Well, says Onecood.
And that's it. That well just kind of hangs in the air for long, drawn-out moments. Finally, you're about to abandon hope of any follow-up when he continues.
It seems things have turned out better for us than I anticipated. And it is time for you and I to have a difficult conversation.
For some reason, you recall the moment in Shamhat's temple when you stepped forward to meet Onecood, only to have the treasury doors slam shut behind you, trap sprung.
What do you mean? This is what I wanted, of course. To be sure, the undoing of the powerful enchantments worked upon you was more than I dared hope for. But it was my desire to drive a wedge between you and your sorceress.
But why? What the hell did I do?
This is where you make your mistake. You think that you are the focus of my efforts. In truth, you are, or were, merely an obstacle to them. I want Warka, the city. I don't need its king, whoever it may be. Causing strife among city leaders makes my task much easier.
It occurs to you only now that where you sit at the foot of this tree is little more than a day's ride from the city. They followed you, probably a day or two behind from the time you left the encampment. Then another bombshell. Shamhat took your throne. Shamhat came to Warka on one could say so in the first place. How did you not see it the moment Mu told you about Shamhat's takeover? So was Shamhat weaseling her way onto my throne while I was out fighting for your people, all part of your brilliant plan as well?
Shamhat rules Warka? Asked Onecood, astonished. So much the better. The takeover will go more smoothly this way.
Well, this is frustrating. You say. I don't get it. If taking Warka was the goal and I was an obstacle to your plan, why not just take me out at the camp? Is it somehow all part of your mastermind crap?
Don't be foolish, Brom. There are no masterminds. What good are plans in a world not bound to go along with them? I do not have plans, but rather intentions.
What in the name of Marduk himself is he going on about? Plans, intentions, what's the difference? What I see is someone who betrayed me and now wants to sit here and mince words with me about it.
Not at all. I didn't plan on you killing so many of our number at the temple. I didn't plan on being unable to overcome you myself. I didn't plan on enjoying your company so much. You wish to know why I did not kill you as you slept. Because I like you. You are a companionable man. So you see, plans crumble, but my intentions never wavered.
Great. Cool story. You like me too much to kill me, but not enough to keep you from stringing me along, feeding me a line about power and will, and watching me head off to completely tank my life.
Ooh, you don't make plans.
Whatever. You're not an agent of chaos, bro. You're just a punk.
Indeed, I lied to you. You are angry. This is fair. I did so with the intention of capturing Warka, and it seems I am to be successful. I won't apologize, but I will tell you why I kept you in the dark and caused you so much hurt.
Awesome. And why is that?
Because I do like you, Brom, but I don't trust you. I don't mean that I find you not to be a man of your word. If you say you'll do something, I believe you will. I just don't know why you're doing anything. I can't fathom your motives. I've told you my intentions for Warka, but they're bigger than that. I want to end my people's ceaseless wanderings. And if I have to carve our new homeland from the bloody carcass of the kingdom that came before, then so be it. This makes me barbarous, conniving, and power-hungry, to be sure, but understandable. The current occupiers may not like that I am taking it from them, but it is no mystery that a king might want a secure and bountiful land for his people, their children, and their children's children. But you, in all our time together, I have never been able to glean your intentions. You seem to have left a life free of want and privation to reap a harvest of death and suffering throughout these lands. And for what? Not for plunder, you barely take anything. Not for sexual conquest, you don't even bother. I could understand a desire to test yourself, but you weren't doing that. If anything, you were testing the power granted you by a sorceress. I am violent and brutal and even cruel, but I carry the weight of my actions with me. I can only bear it because I know it is done so my people might thrive. You, Broam, I can only describe you as indifferent. You commit atrocities for seemingly no reason, and the suffering that comes as a result doesn't touch you. Even the beasts of land, sea, and sky have more cause for their savagery.
Wow. He just said a whole lot of stuff. You just sit there for a while, taking it all in.
Broam, he says, breaking the silence. Do you know what you intend with all this?
It's a question you never thought to ask yourself, so the answer must be no. You aren't going to give him the satisfaction, though, so you muster all the irreverence you can to say, content?
Quite, he says, looking a little disappointed. Well, this time I shall make my intentions perfectly clear. I am going to claim Warka and leaving you here. Do not follow. If you are found within the walls of the city, you will be put to death. As much as I enjoyed our time together, I cannot risk your presence. I intend to build an enduring kingdom, and the only agent of chaos, as you so aptly put it, is you.
That was Broam the Barbarian, Part 2, by Aaron Lund. If you enjoyed this episode and you want to hear more, head on over to Patreon, where you'll find a massive one-hour bonus track that will ratchet up the danger. How will you survive without your powers? Find out in the dramatic conclusion to Broam the Barbarian, only available to patrons. You can find that show by either going to Patreon and running a search for the Twilight Histories, or by going to the website and clicking on our Patreon link. I'm Jordan Harbour. Thanks for listening to the Twilight Histories. Until next time, take care.